For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sale, and this week we're focusing on some blind authors. Fiona Scott Barrett charts the journey of her book, The Exit Facility, from first concept to fully accessible audiobook. 84-year-old debut author Jill Fry describes what life was like for her as a low-vision infant in her memoir, Born Too Soon. Blind crime writer Mark Hardy shares some of the tricks of his trade. And I dust off a hidden gem from the library written by a man who lost his sight when his brother shot him in the eye with an arrow. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Back in February, we featured an exciting new thriller that was not only written by a visually impaired author, but that featured two main characters experiencing sight loss. The Exit Facility by Fiona Scott Barrett is set in a dystopian near future, in which voluntary euthanasia is both legal and encouraged. At the time of our interview, the book was available in print and ebook, but Fiona revealed that she had plans for an audiobook version. Those plans have now come to fruition, as Fiona told me when she joined me from her home in Edinburgh. Fiona, welcome back to Read On.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be back.
Can you just refresh our memories as to the plot and the concept behind The Exit Facility?
Certainly. It's a book set slightly in the future, and the basic premise is that the government of Scotland or Britain, I don't specify which, has introduced exit facilities where people who are terminally ill can go and have a compassionate and dignified death rather than lingering on for a long time. However, what has happened subsequently is that a secondary law has been passed that allows anybody over the age of 25, as long as they're not a taxpayer, to go there and receive a free exit or closure, as it is sometimes referred to. So my heroine, who has been trapped between the classic of elderly parents whose care kind of bled the budget at the same time a youngster was going through university and bleeding the budget at the other end. She's broke. She's also partially sighted, so it's very hard to find work. And she thinks the best thing to do is enter one of these exit facilities and be done with it. And then my daughter can inherit the flat rather than me having to sell it and fritter money away on care, which is what she does. But when she gets there, she discovers that all sorts of things that were not expected and not described in the brochure she read are going on covertly.
It's all too chillingly plausible, and it's a great page turner. Not least because there is a clock ticking down towards your heroine Elaine's exit date. But it's not just that that keeps us turning the pages. I got a real sense of a story that was pushing its way out of you, really needing to be told.
Yes, that is really how it was. And often I would say that I wasn't really sitting there going, oh, what do I write next? I was channeling it. I would see the people in my head and set them in a situation and they took over and they controlled the plot and it just went buzz, buzz, buzz the way they wanted it to, which was very exciting.
And you put a lot of your own observations into the book, particularly about sight loss, both your frustrations at other people's ignorance and the day-to-day bruising encounters that all of us who have lost our sight have to go through. It was clearly important to you to help other people to understand how we see differently.
Yes, it was important to me to put that across to sighted readers, because I find, and I'm sure you also find, that people really are often embarrassed to ask, how do you experience the world? or they just don't understand the concept of being partially sighted, in that you have a certain amount of sight but not your full vision. And I thought it was important to put that over to people who had never experienced that. I also wanted to, you don't get that many heroes or heroines who are either blind or partially sighted in literature. And I thought it was important to write about one, and especially to write about a woman who is, you know, she's in her 60s, so she's not particularly young. She's got the problems of aging as well as the problems of vision.
And when we last spoke, you also said how important it was for you that the exit facility should be recorded as an audiobook, and that has now happened. Can you take us through the book's journey into becoming a talking book?
Certainly. I was exceptionally lucky. I have a friend who was at school with me. We meet up quite rarely for a coffee. And we met up and I said, I would really like this to be an audiobook, because I think it should be an audiobook so that partially sighted and blind people can enjoy it as well. And she said, oh, that's interesting. I've just come out of a studio recording my first, actually her third novel, but the first one that's been recorded, myself as the narrator. And it was a very, very interesting experience. So we spoke about that for a bit, and then she went home, and I went home, found an email from her with this astonishing offer. And she said, I recently came into an unexpected legacy. And she said, it's far, far more money than I need. I would like to pay for you to go into the studio and record your book, specifically so that you can donate a copy for readers with vision loss. So I was absolutely flabbergasted at this kindness, thought about accepting or not. And then I thought, she said it would give her great pleasure to do it. She wants to do this. And so I went ahead, and she had recorded her book at a studio here in Edinburgh that she was very happy with. So I thought, I'll contact that studio and see if I can use them. Yes, they had availability. And then that was the point at which I thought, oh, hold on, I can't read, so I can't record it. What do I do? And one option, obviously, was to hire a professional actor or actress to read. The other was my daughter, who knew the book very, very well. And I said, think that you might like to do this? And she said, oh yes, I've always wanted to do that. So she took 3 days off work and went into a studio every day and recorded the book.
And she has done a fantastic job, as we can hear now.
Behind her, the door opened and closed again, and footsteps approached. Elaine opened her eyes and saw a man carrying two polystyrene cups walk past her. He laid the cups on a pew diagonally opposite hers and sat down. Elaine couldn't restrain herself. Excuse me, she said, but I don't think you should bring hot drinks in here. The wood is so beautiful, it would be a shame to stain it. I entirely agree, he said, but these are not actually hot drinks. His voice was mellifluous and vaguely familiar. The man stood up, moved towards her, his hand stretched out for shaking. Rupert Mortimer, he said. Humanus celebrant. Haven't we met before? The navy blue silk cravat tucked into the neck of his pale pink shirt clinched it. Yes, I'm Elaine, she said. We met at a pre-closure party for two amazing women a couple of weeks ago. Of course, Olivia and Rose, he said. That's right, we did meet, Elaine. I'm surprised you're still here. Oh, I've still got another 12 days to wait. Administrative problems. I'll have waited 30 days in total by the time my exit comes. A look of concern crossed the celebrant's face. My goodness, that seems very inefficient, not to mention downright callous. Indeed. So what brings you back here, Rupert? The girls, he said, glancing at the polystyrene cups.
Constantina Scott Barrett narrating The Exit Facility. written by her mum and my guest, Fiona Scott Barrett.
Fiona, as we can hear, she really takes full charge of the entire cast of the exit facility and has done a terrific job. Is she tempted to give up the day job and become a narrator?
I have suggested it, and I think she is somewhat tempted, yes.
And it must be wonderful for you to hear her narrating the book, especially when actually the protagonist's daughter plays quite a key role in the exit facility.
That is true, though my daughter hates the protagonist's daughter. She says she's a selfish cow. I would never have gone away to the other side of the world and left you behind. So she didn't relate to the protagonist's daughter, but she does relate to the other people in the story.
And you very kindly donated both a PDF copy, which can be turned into Braille, and the talking book version to the RNIB library so that all of our listeners can listen to this brilliant dystopian thriller.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I have. And I hope people enjoy it and relate to it. And I hope it's thought-provoking as well as entertaining.
And I hope that you're working on a sequel or different novel. Any news on that front, or are you taking a well-deserved rest?
No, in fact, I have just returned to a house I lived in for many years, which is not in Cyprus, as my heroine of the exit facility came from, but in Crete, and picked up a whole load of diaries and photographs and letters that I'm going to get somebody to help transcribe for me because I can't read them myself. And I think this will be background material both for a novel and I'm thinking of a memoir. I don't know which I'll do first, though.
Well, Fiona Scott Barrett, thank you so much. I wish you the very best of luck, and I hope you will come back onto the show as and when one or the other of those books is finished. But in the meantime, thank you so much for donating a super dystopian novel to the RNIB library and for coming back onto the show to talk about it again.
It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you again. Thank you.
And thanks to Fiona's generosity, The Exit Facility is now available in both Braille and as a talking book from the RNIB Library. And Fiona will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
Our free mental wellbeing check-ins are available for anyone with sight loss who is struggling with their mental wellbeing. It will help you to address some of the feelings created by the current situation, including anxiety and distress, and to recognise that accepting you have these feelings is a positive step. In an hour-long session over the phone, you'll have the space to share feelings, explore coping strategies, and identify any further support needs you may have. Book today by visiting www.rnib.org.uk/mental-wellbeing-check-in or call 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Still to come in this week's show, crime writer Mark Hardy discusses his Pearson and Russell series, and I review A Hidden Gem by James Thurber. But first, it's never too late to write your story down on the page. Age and experience can provide the seasoning that make a good bit of writing irresistible. Recently, RNIB Connect Radio's Paulina Kusharu interviewed Jill Fry, who only began her writing career in her 80s. Paulina began by asking Jill how her eye condition has affected her life since her earliest childhood and led her to write her memoir, Born Too Soon.
Well, because I'm an albino, the sight tends to be weak anyway. I've called it Born Too Soon, because the things they did then, they wouldn't dream of doing today. And I had the pupils tattooed. The person who did it at the time said that it would help me with the sight and also be cosmetically, you know, better, because my eyes were very red. My parents were guided by the science of the day. it turned out to be making my sight worse. And I know it's worse because I've seen people with sight loss, albinism, and I've seen them at work and they can give them glasses. But unfortunately, they can't actually give me glasses to improve my vision. So that's the situation I was in when I was a baby. Took over four operations to do half the cornea pupil at the time. I was only 6 months old. My mum was in hospital with me because I was being breastfed still at the time. And I wrote it really because also the education that I had was pretty different to what it is today.
It was quite different. And you had a bit of a rebellious streak as well.
I did run away and I did get taken away from school because I was so unhappy. However, I got a home teacher, literally a man who's also had the sight loss, but he was a lot older than me. I was only a little girl at the time. He came once a week to my house and I learned one passage of Braille for the next week so that I had to read it back to him next week. And that's really all I did. But at boarding school, we did maths was done on a steel board with pegs, like a pegboard, really. And we had little steel pegs. And we used to have to put the shape of the numbers. And numbers were always in Braille as well. As regards when I left school, there was nothing there. I wasn't trained for anything. As I say in my book, the boys were trained to do piano tuning and boot repairs at that time. And the girls just went on knitting machines. They used to have great big knitting machines and they had workshops. So you still had to live away to work because obviously the workshops were not everywhere. And that wasn't for me either. But I always wanted to sing. I always envied the girls that sang. And I used to go to tap and ballet dancing. And it was my voice that got me a job for the rest of the working time as a telephonist. And I went to London to train. And my dad came and picked me up every weekend. I stayed there during the week. And, you know, I trained to be a telephonist. But believe you me, by the time I retired, I really had enough. I have a brain and I always wanted to do more, but there weren't the facilities. I mean, now you have readers at university to help people with anything they want read. It's a different world. Mm. And that is why I called my book Born Too Soon.
Like listening to your story and how different your upbringing was, is that the reason you decided to write down your life to show how different it is?
I really wrote it for the grandchildren, you know? Because I remember my grandma lived to be 102 and she died back in the 60s. So if I'd have been interested, but you're not when you're young, you're not interested in what's going on with the older people in that sense. And if I'd have listened to my grandma talking or listened to what she could have gone back another two generations and it probably would have been quite fascinating to hear about the family history. So this is partly why I've written it. And all my friends say, well, I'd love to read it. And they think it's really fascinating and interesting. One friend, he said to me, you've written just how you speak. It's really good. You know, I'm quite pleased with myself, really, to have done it. And again, thanks for the computer age, you know, because obviously that's made a difference to everything. Spelling, my spelling was awful. I mean, I never learned, really didn't learn anything to speak of. Only what my mum and dad taught me. They taught me to do letters, i.e. capital letters, but I never did writing, you know, proper joined up writing or anything like that.
How was it learning, I guess, how to write? Because you wrote a whole book that's over 100 pages later in your life. Did you find that difficult or was that something that technology really helped you finally learn?
Yeah, no, technology was the thing. I did it on the computer. There's still a couple of spelling mistakes, even though my daughter proofread it. It's still a couple of, quite funny, really, because my spelling, when you can't see, well, a lot of people with visually handicapped, they'll tell you it's difficult. Spelling is difficult. But with the computer, you can do the spell checker, and that helps a lot. When my husband passed away, I started doing a journal because I fractured my femur and I had to have my leg up for ages. And I started writing a journal. And from that, I thought, you know what, it's, you know, I will put down what happened to me in the early days. And that's how it started, really.
And I feel like you have this really lovely, like your friend said, you have this lovely sense about writing. It almost feels like a slightly dry sense of humor. It's very matter of fact when you describe certain situations, and it's lovely. Have you ever considered yourself a writer or an author when you were younger, or like even a few years before you started writing?
Well, not really, but I do write one or two little, what I call parodies, where appropriate. So I wrote something for my auntie because she was in a care home years ago, a few years ago. And it was Christmas. She said, I want to do something for entertainment. So I wrote a parody of Cinderella.
Did she like it?
Oh, she did. She did do it, yeah, at Christmas. Yeah. Everybody said it was funny. Yeah, I've done one or two things for friends like that. Silly little things like there's a friend, boy, was eight this year, and his name's Henry. So I'm Henry, I'm eight, I am Henry, I'm eight, I am, you know, blah, blah, that song. So it's things like that I do, but I'm not proper what I call poetry. I just got a sense of humour. And I must admit, I do seem to make people laugh, which is better than making them cry, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm curious, do you listen to audiobooks, or do you have authors or writers that have inspired you in how, I guess, you write or tell your stories, or that you just enjoy, even?
So I like stories about human families, and you know, that sort of thing. It's only really recently that I've got the audiobooks, to be honest. When I say recently, the last few... I've got one of those little boom boxes by the bed, and I get stories from RNIB. I'm not very good on authors because I haven't read enough to be aware. I say to my daughter sometimes, you know, suggest an author, and she's got some on the Alexa for me, but I haven't had time to listen to them much at the moment. I've been too busy, but I can get some books on that. Or I know the type of book I like.
I'm curious, because your story is, it's quite a long story, obviously. You're writing about your whole life. We're talking, what, 84 years?
Mm-hmm.
If you were trying to sell your book to someone, what story, one story from the whole book, would you tell them to try and entice them to read it?
So a person who had sight loss, I would certainly say how medically things have changed so much. If it was just a general public, I would say... my childhood and education, lack of them, that's where it's mostly changed. To be honest with you, Paulina, having written it, and I mean, as you say, I'm 84 now, I suddenly looked back on it and I thought, you know what, I really didn't take control of my life until the menopause. I really think I let things go along until I got to in the 50s when I took control and I went off on my own, which... I mean, I don't think my husband thought I could do, and I'm surprised myself, but, you know, I'm quite a positive person, I suppose, and I'd got to the point where I thought, as far as I know, we only have one life. So I just left and got on with it. I didn't know what I was going to do, where I was going to go, but it all worked out in the end, and...
Because a bit of a spoiler, you met a wonderful gent later in your life, and
you
lived many adventures with him.
We did. And I felt completely safe with him all over the world. We went traveling. They say everybody has a certain amount of good luck in their life, don't they? I think everybody has their share of bad luck and good luck, and mine came nearer the end of it. But having said that, I mean, I was a happy child. It wasn't until the menopause when you start... You know, you're thinking and you get a bit tearful, don't you? I used to have a friend, Beryl, next door, and I used to hear her trotting off in her high heels to the train and thinking, I'll never have that kind of freedom, you know? But as I said, I don't think I really took control until I was in my 50s, to be honest. I mean, if people said I couldn't do something, I accepted it. I mean, my first husband, I mean, he was a good dad, don't get me wrong, but he was set up the first meal. Oh, you can't cook, I better do the cook, I mean, which was nice. I mean, some people would say, well, good on you, you know, lucky you. But it wasn't like that. It was like, he said I couldn't do something and I accepted it. But of course I did, really. I mean, in fact, I loved cooking. I was did lots of cooking and baking, and I went to a course at technical college in those days. I did a typing course at Tech. You know, I was always prepared to have a go.
Did that surprise you, realizing, I guess, later in your life, how much you can actually achieve and how much you can do.
Yeah, that's, yeah, but as I say, you only get one life, and that's all, you know. Although I say born too soon, I'm not complaining as such. And there is no point in getting upset and sad and all the other things, because, you know, all you do is spend the rest of your life being miserable. And I don't do that. I go out a lot. And I go to various organisations. I mean, my daughter works at a doctor's, and she said, we get women in their 60s, or people in their 60s act older than you. I think you've got to be positive about things, and I've tried to be, so, you know.
Yeah, because you might not realise it, but if your grandma is anything to go by, you might have another 20 or maybe even more years in front of you.
That's right. We never know these days. It could be, wouldn't it? I mean, what I mean really, Paulina, is that some people get to a certain age and they sort of give up.
Now, obviously, you finished this book, Born Too Soon. Are there any plans for Born Too Soon 2, or maybe a different title?
Well, you made me think now. I'll have a think about that one. I didn't bring in too much about the rest of the family. I mean, they obviously figured in my life, but it was about really starting off with my eyes and stuff like that. It does feel a bit funny now not having some writing to do. But it would have to be something completely different.
Obviously, your book, you've written it down. It's in a PDF format, so it's something you can download on a Kindle and read that way. But you have sent it to a publisher as well, so there's hope that maybe you will see your book published.
It might be, and I've got hard copies anyway.
So if someone wanted to maybe get a peek at your book, even if it's just a few passages, or maybe if you were feeling very generous and sharing the whole book, could they get in touch with you?
Yeah, I'd love them to.
I'll give out the email address in a moment. But Jill, in the meantime, it's been so lovely speaking with you. And I really appreciate you taking your time to share your story on RNAB Connect Radio.
Thank you.
And if you would like to get in touch with Jill, her email address is jillfry123@btinternet.com.
Thanks to Paulina and to Jill Fry.
Hi, my name's Colin Daniels. I work for the Macular Society, and I started reading audiobooks, funny enough, when I was in hospital once. I never used to read audiobooks at all, but my data for streaming stuff while I was laid up in hospital started to run out. So audiobooks was the way forward. So I joined, funny enough, the RNIB Talking Book Library. My favourite audiobook actually is Russell Brand's biography called My Bookie Wook. And the reason I liked it so much was because he read it himself, and it was almost like you lived that bit of his life with him. He read it in a very funny way, in a very poignant way, and in a really nice way as well, very inspirational, learning a lot about his life and how he's got to where he's got. I continue to read books. My favourite place to read them is sitting in my back garden, because it's south-facing, in the sun, with a nice glass of wine.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before blind crime writer Mark Hardy shares some of the secrets of his success...
Some of the most famous names in literature were blind. Homer, Milton, Joyce and Borges. They all suffered sight loss, but in most cases it only improved their writing. Whether it's coincidence that they're all rather heavyweight literary authors is up for debate. If you'd like to find out for yourself, then there's a wide selection of their work available from the RNIB library. And believe me, having Ulysses narrated to you is much easier than having to read it yourself. By contrast, the author I'm talking about today is light reading, but the gems in his books sparkle just as brightly. James Thurber was 7 when he was blinded by an arrow in a game of William Tell with his brother. He lost the sight in one eye completely and was left with limited and failing vision in the other. But this didn't stop him from becoming one of the most popular and respected humorists of the 20th century. Known as the Mark Twain of his era, His stories, essays and cartoons set the standard for a generation of other American writers. And over 50 years after Thurber's death, they are still funny and fascinating. He's best known for the classic, surreal short story, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, which is the opening story in My World and Welcome to It, a brilliant collection of Thurber's writing that I downloaded from the library.
The crew, bending to their various tasks in the huge, hurtling 8-engine Navy hydroplane, looked at each other and grinned. "Yeah, the old man'll get us through," they said to one another. "The old man ain't afraid of hell."
"Not so fast. You're driving too fast," said Mrs. Mitty. "What are you driving so fast for?" "Hmm?" said Walter Mitty. He looked at his wife in the seat beside him with shocked astonishment. She seemed grossly unfamiliar, like a strange woman who had yelled at him in a crowd.
"You were up to 55," she said. "You know I don't like to go more than 40. You were up to 55.
Like many of the other stories in this volume, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty is a combination of the humdrum and the absurd. Thurber's world is a joyous mix of the familiar and the surreal that always reminds me of part animated films like Who Framed Roger Rabbit. The characters and situations he creates are liable to pop out into a comic book dimension at any moment, giving the reader a glimpse of just how petty and dull day-to-day lives can appear sometimes. The collection also contains a wonderfully silly and very clever spoof on Shakespeare in the Macbeth murder mystery, and a story called Interview with a Lemming that is as wry and relevant now as it was in 1942. If there's a theme that runs through the majority of the 22 stories in the first part of My World and Welcome to It, it's man's ability to be driven to distraction by small, seemingly innocuous things. For the most part, this takes the form of laughing along with the frustrations of ordinary people, as in the story The Preoccupation of Mr. Pettifoss.
"In a time when everything should be made as simple and uncomplicated as possible, the Connecticut Telephone Company has taken to changing a lot of peaceful old rural phone numbers, which had been doing all right the way they were. Now, lots worse things have happened to me, but not many that I keep thinking about more often."
But this collection also contains two of the darkest stories that Thurber ever wrote, A Friend to Alexander and The Whippoorwill, the latter a chilling horror about the psychological effects of repetitive birdsong.
"It slowly carved out a recurring nightmare in which Kinstry was attacked by an umbrella whose handle, when you clutched it, clutched right back. For the umbrella was not an umbrella at all, but a raven. Through the gloomy hallways of his mind rang the thing's dolorous cry, 'Nevermore, nevermore, nevermore, Whippoorwill, Whippoorwill.'"
Sometimes I wonder if this awareness of how thin the line between absurdity and madness is gives us an insight into Thurber's mind. His crazy cartoon world is very funny, till it's not. Walter Mitty's fantasies border on the schizophrenic. Like many people who are severely sight-impaired, Thurber suffered from hallucinations caused by Charles Bonnet syndrome. These take the form of often very weird figures. For the most part, they are benign, but in some cases they can be deeply disturbing and make it difficult to distinguish between what's real and what's illusion. When, in The Whippoorwill, Kinstry snaps, "There's nothing in life to be sure about," I wonder if that's Thurber speaking. The second part of My World and Welcome to It consists of an 8-chapter comic memoir about the time Thurber spent in France shortly after World War I. They're a lovely evocation of a bygone age, but lack the punch of the other stories in the volume. All in all, I think that Thurber's writing, like that of Homer, Milton, Joyce and Borges, acquired an additional dimension because of his sight loss. It's a sense of something invisible and uncertain that sharpens his observations. My Life and Welcome to It contains some of his best work, and the talking book version, read by William Roberts, is TB10156. Have you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like us to feature on the show? Or do you have a favourite book that you'd like to share with Ellie's Book Club on the Afternoon Edition?
You can drop us a line by emailing radio@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
Hi there, I'm David Hogg, and if you want to keep up to date with the very latest in rock, pop, indie, and everything in between, then you can tune in to A Little Alternative. Every Friday night from 9, I play the hottest alternative tracks around in a bid to get your weekend off to a flyer. So that's A Little Alternative, and you can tune in every Friday night from 9 p.m, repeated Saturday nights at 7 p.m, only on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On. Now, before we return to Fiona Scott-Barrett to hear the books of her life.
Mark Hardy is an author with a backstory. He only took up writing after losing his sight completely in 2002. His first book, Burned and Broken, was snapped up by a major publishing house and has drawn comparisons with other crime writers such as Peter Robinson and Ian Rankin. It's a gritty, gripping police procedural set in the Essex town of Southend-on-Sea, a place where hope seems to have receded with the tide. Mark Hardy, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, I believe you only became a writer when you finally lost all your sight in 2002.
That's right. Before I lost my sight, I was working as a computer consultant, running my own business in the City of London. And then I lost my sight and I started an open university course, which was actually in history. But I found that wasn't very interesting. So I looked around for creative writing courses and I was surprised to find that the open university did one. So I went on that and I really enjoyed it. And I was getting very good feedback from my tutor. So I thought, hey, I might have a talent for this, or, you know, might be able to go a bit further with it. But I didn't think at that time that I was going to necessarily have anything published. It was just really for my own satisfaction that I was doing it.
As somebody who is blind and a writer myself, the challenges of actually editing your own work sometimes are quite insuperable. How do you go about writing and editing your work?
I always use a computer. I learnt to touch type, and I use a screen reader. I actually use JAWS at the moment, and I use that via Microsoft Word. The editing process is very tough, so I write a chapter at a time into a Word document, and then if I'm needing to edit large paragraphs or large chunks of text, I usually copy them into a different document, edit them in there, and then paste them back in. So it'll generally turn out to be quite a messy way of doing it, and very cumbersome, but it's the best way I've found so far.
And I mean, a bit like Morecambe and Wise, you cannot see the join in your writing. I've found myself marvelling at how well it flows. Do you have somebody read it to you afterwards, a proper human voice rather than the JAWS voice?
I don't have somebody read it back to me as such. No, I listen to it on JAWS. I've got a synthetic voice, not the, you know, the Stephen Hawking type original voice. So I use, I think it's RealSpeak I use at the moment. But I listen to it back. But I do have a number of readers who read it in the text form and then comment on it. And it goes through various stages to get through to the, you know, the polished product, but not, they don't really read it back to me as such. But I think the JAWS voice is not ideal, but it's quite good. And when it actually comes through to the audio production side of it, right at the end, and you've got a human narrator, I think that really adds to it, and that really sort of reinforces to me that, you know, I know where I'm going, and I can almost hear the voices, the dialogue.
It certainly shows, and actually I was going to ask you about your ear for dialogue. It's spot on. You
And I've spent a fair amount of time in Southend over the years. and I could imagine myself walking along the seafront and listening to some of those voices pouring out of the nightclub. How do you do your visual research? Because many of the passages are very descriptive. Do you just have a very good memory for what you used to be able to see?
I suppose that's part of it. You know, I lost my sight 15 years ago now, but you sort of view everything through a haze of nostalgia. So things that were mundane to you at the time that you could see, you know, puddles and, you know, the mud flats and the grey sky, now they, because you're looking back on them in almost a romantic way, you can sort of conjure that vision back in a very sort of rich way. But I usually go out to a scene that I want to describe with my wife, and I'll stand there and listen to the sounds, get the smells and get the atmosphere of it, and I think that comes quite across in the description. And then it may be an area that I have visited before and I could see, or it may not, but I'll get my wife to describe certain things, and I'll say, you know, what colour is it? What type of colour is it? And what's the texture? And if it, you know, if we're near something that I want to describe, I'll actually go and feel it, much to her embarrassment.
Oh, so there was a palm tree that you went and hugged, rather like your character.
I did actually do that, and my wife was quite embarrassed at the time.
And the police procedural aspects are spot on. Are you just very good at your research, or...?
I've actually got a powers of police advisor, so I think of the scenario and I think of it, how would I investigate it as a reasonably intelligent person, and I have a crack at doing it. And then I'll pass it over to Phil. He was, luckily enough, an ex-DCI in the major incident team in Essex. So I'll say to him, how would you have gone about investigating this crime? Can you give me any little pointers, little tips, little things that police, you know, might say, their attitudes, how they would speak to each other? I think that's quite an important part of the whole thing as well. So I do have expert advice once I've had a go at trying to write it myself.
Are you a big crime fan anyways? Was that the type of fiction that you felt drawn to write?
Yes and no. I sort of alternate between crime fiction and literary fiction, to be honest. But I'll often read a crime fiction book and think, well, you know, the plot was okay, but the characters were a bit shallow, or, you know, wasn't a lot of depth to anything other than the storyline. And then I'll read maybe a literary fiction book and think, you know, the prose is beautiful, it's, the characterisation is fantastic, but what actually happened at the end of it? You know, nothing's moved on, nothing's resolved, the characters haven't had their journey, you know, for want of a better phrase. So I do sort of alternate between it, but I would say I probably, if anything, I lean more to literary fiction. But to me, a good book is a good book, and usually that's something, a book that's well written, and you can actually tell by reading it that the author's put a lot of time and effort into writing it, and that's all I look for really in a book.
I like the surrealist touches that you certainly brought to Burnt and Broken and Truly Evil, the different way that different people can see the world around them. You and I both know that if you are blind, you see the world in quite a different way to those who are sighted. Did you feel that that was an important element to bring into your books?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Maybe it's treated in a slightly different way in Burned and Broken, but obviously, as soon as you lose your sight, your perception of the world is different from other people's, and I think everyone's got their own different view of the world. And people, you might meet people and say, oh, well, he was quite nice, and then, you know, whoever you're with saying, well, I didn't like him. You know, and they'll pick up on something. I didn't like the way he talked. I didn't like his mannerisms, or, you know, he was a bit patronising, or, you know, something like that. So I think that was quite a good driver towards the book. One of the narratives in the book is the detective inspector who gets killed very early on.
Mm.
And one of the premises of the book is that the older male detective and the younger female detective have got very different views of him. And as the book progresses, both of their views change, but as their views change, we get an insight into their characters as well. But on the other side of it, the more surrealist side, I don't know what other blind people see, but people have got the idea that, you know, it's darkness, it's blackness. What I actually see is patterns of light all the time and shifting light, and it's quite disturbing to me, and it's something that I've struggled to get used to over, you know, 15 years. And I wanted to sort of portray that, and I think the best way to come across that is to do something where the actual person who's involved has got a very different perception of the world. So I thought about one of the characters is on the spectrum of schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
So and schizophrenics see quite different view of the world. And so that idea of somebody seeing that as an absolute reality when it's something completely different to what other people see was quite interesting to me. And that is obviously viewed through the prism of a different perception of the way you see the world when you do become blind.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you a keen audiobook user then?
Yes, I listen to... I've always got a book on the go, and it's probably where I get my main interest outside of writing is actually reading or listening to music. So yes, I've always got an audio book on the go, and I've probably got one ready to go after that as well.
I find it one of the few compensations of being blind is that actually, just like in childhood, somebody's reading to me nowadays. And certainly the audiobook version of Burned and Broken is very powerfully read. You must have been pleased to have heard it.
I was absolutely delighted when I listened to it. And actually, there was a very long process to go about to get the reader that we decided on at the end. Once again, Little Brown Sphere were very supportive in that, and we actually spoke about the narrator for the audio book in the very first meeting that I had with them. But it was a very long process because I had a very particular tone of voice in mind. I wanted him to be, having listened to so many audio books, I wanted a particular delivery, you know, not as if somebody's reading a book to me, but as if they're actually there, they're telling you the story, or, you know, in a way they're acting out the story for you. So it's almost they're narrating a book, but it's dramatised as well. So, and I wanted a very specific tone and atmosphere, which I described to them as sort of like a film noir voiceover, but done in a London accent. So I didn't sound too much of a challenge. And they came up with quite a lot of different people, and I was saying to them, no, he's too posh, no, he's too, he reads, that sounds like a book, no, he's not, he's too dramatic, he's not dramatic enough, and, you know, I was getting a lot of emails back saying, no, don't apologise, we're glad that you're so engaged with the process, and we're always up for a challenge, and all this sort of thing. I think they really were just saying to me, you're a pain in the backside, so...
Well, it came good in the end. Rupert Holiday Evans really nails it, doesn't he?
He does. I think I was absolutely delighted when I heard the audio. If the series continues, then Rupert will continue to narrate it for me.
Pearson had to lean forward to peer through the windscreen. Beyond the wiper's reach, a layer of dust clung to the stickiness of tree sap. Coronas of light refracted around the more obstinate patches inside the cleared space. And at its very centre sat a newly deposited splat of bird shit. He could see that a line of blue and white tape had already been strung across the road. Behind this, Socko's unloaded metal boxes from a van, and a white forensic tent was being assembled. The crime scene manager, in a white forensic suit, 6'8" and stick thin, was in conversation with a man who stood at least a foot shorter. Detective Chief Inspector Martin Roberts. His thinning red hair, lifted by the faintest of breezes, had a between-standard sizes body that left him constantly tucking in his shirt or adjusting some or other item of clothing. His West Country burr and ruddy complexion more suited a farmer or the owner of a garden centre than the senior investigating officer of the Essex Major Incident Team.
Rupert Holliday Evans narrating Truly Evil by Mark Hardy, which, like Burned and Broken, is available from the RNIB Library. And book three in the Pearson and Russell series, Almost Dark, will be joining them soon. Now it's back to Fiona Scott Barrett for the books of her life.
Fiona, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
As a youngster, I had very eclectic tastes. But when I got to being a teenager, I was very serious in those days. And I absolutely adored Animal Farm and then went on from there to 1984. So I think I've had an interest in dystopian literature since that early age. And I revisited Animal Farm of George Orwell lately and was astonished at how good it still is. I mean, it appealed to me when I was about 12 as a child. And then I reread it maybe 5 or 6 years ago and thought, this book works on so many levels. It is really amazing.
It had happened at last. The expected message had come. All his life, it seemed to him, he had been waiting for this to happen. He was walking down the long corridor at the ministry, and he was almost at the spot where Julia had slipped the note into his hand, when he became aware that someone larger than himself was walking just behind him. The person, whoever it was, gave a small cough, evidently as a prelude to speaking. Winston stopped abruptly and turned. It was O'Brien. At last, they were face to face. And it seemed that his only impulse was to run away. His heart pounded violently. He would have been incapable of speaking. O'Brien, however, had continued forward in the same movement, laying a friendly hand for a moment on Winston's arm, so that the two of them were walking side by side. He began speaking with the peculiar grave courtesy that differentiated him from the majority of inner party members. "I had been hoping for an opportunity of talking to you," he said. "I was reading one of your Newspeak articles in the Times the other day. You take a scholarly interest in Newspeak, I believe?"
Gordon Griffin, narrating 1984 by George Orwell, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, I am a huge fan of Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which again, not dystopian, but it is science fiction, has a lot of humour in it. Also a bit of tragedy and a lot of philosophy. So I love the fact that it brings in all these different aspects. It never fails to entertain. I've probably read all 5 volumes of it 6, 7, 8 times throughout my life, and it always gives pleasure when I go back to it.
Far out in the uncharted backwaters of the unfashionable end of the western spiral arm of the galaxy lies a small, unregarded yellow sun. Orbiting this at a distance of roughly 92 million miles is an utterly insignificant little blue-green planet whose ape-descended life forms are so amazingly primitive that they still think digital watches are a pretty neat idea. This planet has, or rather had, a problem, which was this. Most of the people living on it were unhappy for pretty much of the time. Many solutions were suggested for this problem, but most of these were largely concerned with the movements of small green pieces of paper, which is odd because on the whole it wasn't the small green pieces of paper that were unhappy. And so the problem remained. Lots of the people were mean, and most of them were miserable, even the ones with digital watches.
Gordon Gilliou narrating The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, a book that I have really enjoyed and read quite recently is a non-fiction book called Entangled Life, and it's by Merlin Sheldrake. And it is the story of fungi and how there is a huge web of information flowing about underneath our feet that is transmitted through what is known as the wood wide web. And that is a huge network of fungi that interconnect with each other. It's still not absolutely certain what means they use to send messages, but there are all these messages flowing about from place to place, interconnecting with trees, and absolutely amazing. And it is also exquisitely narrated by the author. So it's a pleasure to listen to, and the ideas in it and the science and the potential that the book offers for new medicines, new products, things that would be more sustainable using lessons learned from fungi or fungi themselves is absolutely inspirational. So I would recommend that very highly.
Fungi are everywhere, but they're easy to miss. They're inside you and around you. They sustain you and all that you depend on. As you hear these words, fungi are changing the way that life happens, as they have done for more than a billion years. They are eating rock, making soil, digesting pollutants, nourishing and killing plants, surviving in space, inducing visions, producing food, making medicines, manipulating animal behavior, and influencing the composition of the Earth's atmosphere. Fungi provide a key to understanding the planet on which we live and the ways that we think, feel, and behave. Yet they live their lives largely hidden from view, and over 90% of their species remain undocumented. The more we learn about fungi, the less makes sense without them.
Merlin Sheldrake narrating his book Entangled Life: How Fungi Make Our Worlds, Change Our Minds, and Shape Our Futures, which is available from the RNIB Library.
Fiona Scott-Barrett, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show today.
Thank you, it's been a pleasure.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, and Robert Kirkwood is at talking_books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.